Welcome to Stepping Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and my guest today is Marcy Darnofsky. Marcy has been teaching politics of science and technology for some years and is now working with Exploratory Initiative of the New Human Genetic Technologies. So this is a very, very important subject that we don't hear much about, and I'm really happy to be able to be able to have Marcy Darnofsky speak to us today about it because, you'll hear genetic technologies. So, Marcy, we've just been talking about the importance of what's going on with technology and science and how frequently people don't have a clue, don't understand how much it's affecting their lives. And from what I've read about this genetic engineering, it's really, especially with humans, but any of it is, it's pretty, it couldn't possibly be more important. So where do we start? I guess explaining what it is.
Right, I think it is important to explain because it's a confusing topic, and especially because there are some human genetic technologies that are worthy of support, or that at least should be subject to the same kind of questions we should be asking about other technologies. Is this safe? Is this effective? Is there going to be equal access? Is this the right place, the right priority for our research dollars, and so on? And a lot of human genetic technologies fall into that category. They are technologies that potentially are beneficent. They could alleviate people's suffering. They could help treat or even cure some diseases. And it would sure be nice to feel that we could enthusiastically support those kind of human genetic technologies with those ends. But there are also some human genetic technologies that are coming very, very fast down the line and that very few people are aware of at all, that are so dangerous and that could lead to such a horrible future, and the consequences are so, so large. And those are the ones that the group I'm working with, the Exploratory Initiative on the New Human Genetic Technologies, those are the ones on which we're mainly focused, because we feel that there are some technologies or some applications of human genetic technologies that we should just take them off the table. We need to forego them because of the consequences that I'll tell you about, the future that they could lead to.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's just get right into it. What are those things that you just like to totally take away because they're so serious?
Well, they're technologies of human genetic manipulation. They're technologies that would allow people to manipulate the genes that they pass on to their children. So we're talking here about what the media often calls designer babies, designer children. And it is a form, a new form of eugenics. And it's a technology that for many, many years, people, scientists theoretically knew could be contemplated, and that the vast majority of scientists and religious figures and ethicists always said, we would never do this. It's too dangerous. It's too consequential. We have no right to alter the genetic legacy of the human species. It was always considered taboo. But in recent years, that taboo has lifted.
I'd like you to explain the word eugenics. I mean, I'm not sure exactly what it means, but I certainly do connect it with Nazi Germany and Hitler.
Yes, that's what most people connect it to. And most people are surprised to learn that there was a very popular and widespread eugenics movement in this country, in the United States, at the turn of the century, in the early years of the 20th century. And the idea here was that we should be selecting human beings who had superior genes, however that would be defined, and encouraging people who had inferior genes not to reproduce. And that those ideas that people could be selected for as better or worse people on the basis of what was thought to be their genes, because at that time, of course, we just looked at the characteristics that people had. We couldn't look at genes then. No one could do that. But the idea was that on the basis of these presumed genetic characteristics, that there was a right to tell people not to reproduce or to encourage them to reproduce more. And some supporters of eugenics were more and less coercive about that. And the more coercive ones in this country led to policies like the exclusion of certain ethnic groups in immigration policies, led to forced sterilizations of people who were considered, for example, feeble-minded, which was this, you know, catch-all category that anybody could have been put in and was put in.
And it always depends who's deciding these things, of course, who makes these judgments, these decisions about what's better than what. I have a bumper strip on my car that says, who decides, you know. That's always something to keep in mind. Anyway, back to this particular subject.
Right, that's the key question. You know, who decides and on what basis? So eugenics means selection of human beings on the basis of presumed genetic characteristics, or on the basis of characteristics that are assumed to be controlled or heavily influenced by genes. The Nazis took that to an extreme, of course, and it led to a genocidal situation. It led to the Holocaust. Now, the people who we say are engaging in a new form of eugenics would certainly take exception to being called eugenicists. They would say, we're not talking about anything related to that. Eugenics is about coercion by state governments, and we're not talking about that. We're talking about voluntary parental choice. We're talking about consumers getting to decide what kind of characteristics to pass on to their children. So they would reject completely that notion that they're engaged in eugenics. Or else they might say, well, you know, if we're engaged in eugenics, then it's eugenics when people choose a mate to reproduce with because they're choosing certain characteristics that they think will be perpetuated in their children. So either they say, no, it has nothing to do with us, or, oh, well, this is nothing new. Mm-hmm. But the people that I'm working with, the critics of the new human genetic technologies, say that, well, it's a different kind of eugenics, that's for sure, but let's look at what kind it is.
Free market determined, huh?
Exactly. It's going to be the global marketplace here, and what it means is that, well, first let's talk about how this would actually, how it would work. How would you decide that you wanted a designer child and go about getting one? Well, the advocates of this technology, they are very, very explicit about the way they see this future, and they don't see it as so far off. In their vision, when people want to have children, they will go to fertility clinics, they will have children the way that people who use in vitro fertilization now have children. In other words, a human egg and a human sperm will come together in a petri dish, and a fertilized embryo will be created. And this technology, of course, now is used to help people who are having fertility problems. But in the vision of the human future that the advocates of this designer baby technology envision, people who want to have, who would like to be able to enhance their children will use this technology, this reproductive technology. And when the fertilized embryo is in this petri dish, technicians will go in and they will substitute genes created in the laboratory for the genes naturally occurring in the embryo. They'll put in certain genes, they'll take out certain genes, they'll use human artificial chromosomes. Now, there's no precise way to do this right now. We'll talk more about, you know, how realistic is this. But this is their vision. The parents will be able to go to the fertility clinic and literally select their children's traits from a catalog. That's the vision. Now, these advocates are also very explicit about the fact that it's going to be expensive. This fertility technology is very expensive today, and it is not covered by health insurance in most cases, and is affordable only by people who are affluent. And many of the advocates of this technology are very clear. Designer baby technology will also be available only to the well-off. And so, they say, as the wealthy people use this technology to enhance their children, and those children who have these inborn, in this case, advantages, accrue that much more influence and wealth, and they use it on their children, and so on and so forth, we will see the emergence of genetic castes. Now, many of the, this is not something you have to read between the lines with a lot of these guys. They write about this stuff. And one of them, for example, is this mouse geneticist at Princeton University named Lee Silver. He's written a book called Remaking Eden. And in that book, he spins out these scenarios of the future, the ones I've just been telling you about. And he talks about a time a couple hundred years from now when in the United States, 10% of the population will be genetically enhanced. And he calls those people the gen rich. And he says the gen rich will control the government, the media, academia, entertainment, so on and so forth. And the other 90% of the population, whom he calls the naturals, he says, quote, they will sweep the floors, unquote. And he goes on to explain how, gee, this, you know, is a little problematic. We're going to be increasing inequality this way. Some people won't like it. But this technology is inevitable, he says. And he concludes, the global marketplace will reign supreme. Those are his words. So that's the vision. It's a vision of consumer eugenics and genetic castes. And many of these scientists talk very openly about seizing control of human evolution and about entering a post-human future where there are a few people who decide what kinds of characteristics are going to be made available for the next generations, where some human beings are allowed to actually engineer other human beings. That's the kind of eugenic future that they're forecasting and eagerly anticipating.
Well, that's really incredibly intense. There's no doubt about that. And you're talking about fertility. Of course, fertility, I don't want to get off on too much on the subject of fertility, but just to say that infertility is very, very high in the world, as far as I can tell, because of the chemicals and the environmental issues going on that are not good for people. I mean, that's a whole other issue. But, I mean, more and more people are not able to have kids unless they go through some kind of scientific process, just as a little aside there. Well, it is really serious, people. Really, I'm glad that you are working, Marcy Darnowski, with organization Exploratory Initiative of the New Human Genetic Technologies, because it's really important for people to know about this. And you also say it's particularly a women's issue. Well, of course, it's women who have babies who will carry these kids if they're not, I guess they have to be carried by women sooner or later, right? Even if it's engineered in the laboratory?
Well, yes, currently that's certainly true, unless, as there are some scientists who would like to and who are working on developing artificial wombs. But so far, that's, I don't know, maybe even further off in the future than the early days of this technology. The technology that I'm talking about is sometimes called germline genetic engineering. And the reason it's called germline is because it works on the so-called germ cells, the sex cells, the egg, or the sperm cells of human beings. And germline genetic engineering means that whatever changes are made will get passed on to the child who develops out of the embryo that's manipulated, and also to all the children that children might have, so to all subsequent generations. And that's different from the other kind of genetic engineering that we are hearing more and more about in the news, which is often called gene therapy. So-called gene therapy is targeted at existing human beings, not at future human beings when they're embryos. So-called gene therapy is meant to help people who are suffering from diseases. And it hasn't been very effective, and that's unfortunate, really, in a sense. What I've learned as I've looked more into it is that what a lot of people have learned, actually, is that the problems are not just in the effectiveness of that kind of genetic engineering, the gene therapy kind of genetic engineering, but also in its safety. And here we get into the problems that are more familiar to us about conflicts of interest between the researchers who are running these gene therapy experiments and biotechnology companies for which they're often working and who stand to benefit if the experiment is a success. So what happens is these researchers have an incentive to push ahead, to make the outcome look better than it actually is, to put people at risk. And one of the results of that was that in September of 1999, so a little over a year ago now, there was an 18-year-old young man who enrolled in one of these gene therapy trials, and he died as a result of it. And the subsequent investigations uncovered a lot of problems in terms of conflicts of interest, in terms of the young man and his family not being fully informed of the risks. And then what happened was that investigators found that it wasn't just this one case. It was dozens of cases all over the country where the researchers weren't properly reporting problems and so on. So some people have said now, well, we shouldn't call this gene therapy. It hasn't really helped anyone. We should call it genetic experiments on human subjects. But it's very important, no matter what criticisms we have of the way that kind of genetic engineering is being run, I want to go back to the point I made at the beginning of our talk and say that if they can develop that kind of genetic engineering in ways that make it safe, that make it effective, that make it accessible, you know, that kind of genetic engineering can help people. But this other kind, this germline genetic engineering, this designer baby technology, that's the one that really could lead to these very horrific futures, that eugenic futures that I was describing and that Lee Silver describes and then says we should go for anyway.
Yeah. Post-human, well, that's a pretty heavy thing. People should meditate on that one, the post-human society.
Yes, it's a society in which the natural world, including the human world, is thoroughly and completely transformed, technologically transformed, and under the control of whoever is controlling the technology, which in our society would be large corporations, large biotechnology corporations. So those kinds of issues are all part of this. This is a situation that should be of concern to anyone who cares about human equality, because I really think it constitutes saying that we want to work towards a society of genetic castes, towards a society of the gen-rich and the naturals. I think it really constitutes abandoning commitments to human equality that have been the bedrock of progressive and liberal thought even since the French Revolution and since the Enlightenment. I think it's that important. So that goes for everybody who cares about equality and who cares about social justice.
Right. Well, this word human is a kind of it's an interesting word. I mean, I don't know. I think that many people say, well, they refer to certain things that are usually considered positive qualities, and they talk about that's what it is to be human. And I think what it is to be human, humans are already doing horrible things to each other. I don't know what this means to be human, but seems to me and many of us that the further we get away from the natural world, the worse things get, and that's kind of the root of everything. Well, that's my opinion, and I know I'm not alone in it. In some way. So this is really serious. If you would talk, Marcy Darnofsky, about the issue for particularly for women.
Sure. Well, as you said, of course, it will be women who are carrying these genetically engineered embryos, fetuses, children, and caring for them. And one thing that we know from the animal experiments is that the children themselves and in some cases the women in the cases of animals, the female animals who carry them have been affected. That's been true in cloning, reproductive cloning. So that's a related technology, producing human beings by cloning them.
Right. Talk a little bit about that, actually, because we haven't really mentioned it.
No.
And cloning is... it's just so far out. It's hard to even imagine, but I know it is being done.
the cloning of animals is being done quite widely and routinely at this point. Cloning of human beings has not been done, although that technology is really even closer than the germline genetic technology I was talking about, because they've been working it out so in so many different animal species.
So I mean, really means you reproduce something exactly like the thing that you took. I mean, I'm not anything of a scientist, but I imagine a lot of the listeners aren't either.
Well, let me explain it and we can go through it really quickly, and it's not that hard. What cloning involves is taking a cell from the person you want to clone. So if we wanted to clone Sue, we would take a cell from Sue, a skin cell, a hair cell, whatever kind of cell. The scientist would remove the nucleus from Sue's cell and somehow, there's different methods, put it into an egg, a human egg that was obtained from Sue or from another woman. So instead of, and that cell with that was made of a nucleus of Sue's cell and a human egg could then be induced to grow into an embryo, and if it was put into a woman's uterus, to grow into a fetus and to be born 9 months later as a child who had nearly the exact same genetic makeup as Sue, because the child was created out of only Sue's cell.
And all you need is a piece of hair.
Oh, my God.
And a human egg and a lot of technology. Now, this is being done in animals currently, and turns out there are a lot of differences between different species. So you have to do different techniques, and you have to do a lot of tries. It's not an exact science, but you know, if you have a couple of hundred sheep eggs and a couple of hundred cells from sheep, at this point, they can usually get a cloned sheep out of it. Human beings might turn out to be very different than sheep. Some other species have. On the other hand, a lot is known about human reproductive physiology, much more than is known about most animals' reproductive physiology. Now, in many countries, human reproductive cloning and germline genetic engineering are against the law. You can't do it. They're banned. It's prohibited. So a lot of people say or feel, gee, you know, this sounds horrible, but how can we stop it? It's inevitable. Technology has its own momentum. Well, it's not really the case. We can stop it, and that's, of course, the work that we're engaged in. But one of the things that makes us hopeful is that in many countries, these technologies already have been outlawed. In Japan, for example, there was a recent law passed, and now if you try to produce a human being by cloning, you go to jail for 10 years. It's a felony in Japan. So it's seen as a very serious violation of human rights and of the social good. And many countries, without even a lot of public debate, it was just an obvious thing that this is not something we want to do. That's not a road we want to go down. So we're going to make it against the law. Doesn't mean that no one's going to break the law, but it sure is a different world than if you're allowed to do it. Now, in the United States, there are a couple of states that have temporarily banned human reproductive cloning. And one state, Michigan, has outlawed it permanently. At a federal level, you're not allowed to use federal monies if you're a researcher to work on human reproductive cloning. But if you're working in the private sector, there are absolutely no restrictions at all.
People can do it.
So we can think that outlawing human cloning and human germline engineering is possible, it's doable. At some point, we'll actually need a global ban on these technologies if it's going to be effective. Because without that, of course, we could just be opening the door to what you might call eugenic tourism, and that we don't want. So we're working toward that. What we're doing now is alerting different constituencies that this technology is coming, that there's a group of scientists and influential political pundits and others who are pushing this technology very aggressively. They're out there promoting it in the media, in public conferences, in scientific journals, in the popular press. And still, even though they're doing all that, a lot of people just haven't realized the full implications of it yet in the full picture. So we're working to alert people, environmentalists, women's organizations, progressive religious organizations, children's advocates, the whole range of civil society organizations. And when we get some of that work under our belt, we'll hope that we'll be able to also start reaching out much more effectively to the public and hope that we can help catalyze a grassroots politics around these issues and around these technologies as well.
And in something I read, you were talking about how it really ties into the choice issue.
Yes.
For women.
For women, right. A lot of the advocates of human germline engineering and human cloning are presenting it as an issue of choice. They say, what, you're telling me we're gonna tell women they can't choose how they, what kind of children they have? And what we're saying is, yes, we are telling women that. We're saying that the right to end an unwanted pregnancy, of course we support, and that's apples, and that's what we fought for. But the right to manipulate the genetic makeup of your child, that's oranges, and that has such horrific consequences and implications that we're telling you, you can't do that. That's not an individual right, and that's not what the women, what women who fought for abortion rights meant by reproductive choice. So that's a key point about for women's health and reproductive rights organizations, as well as the issues around safety and around what kinds of the lives of children that would be created and those issues around women's health.
And then all the issues of women as an oppressed group, I mean, sometimes anyway, and being controlled by men who have more money, more power, whatever. I mean, it just can get very, very complicated.
Well, I think that's right. Yeah, it opens up a lot of doors for people controlling other people and historically targeted groups of all kinds, groups that have been targeted because of their race, because of their gender, because of their sexual orientation. In a world where there's this much power over other human beings and over which characteristics are considered okay and worth perpetuating, we're going to just exacerbate, perpetuate all those kinds of prejudices and biases.
Well, this is, for me anyway, the beginning of a conversation that really, really needs to go on, because there's a lot of genetic engineering going on around racial issues, around all kinds of things. I have the idea, and it's just so important, as you say, for people to be aware of this. So hopefully we've really triggered some consciousness here. And how does one get hold of your organization, Marcy Darnofsky?
Right now, the way to reach the Exploratory Initiative on the New Human Genetic Technologies is through an email address, and if you write to us, we'll send you an occasional, it's about every 4 to 6 weeks, a newsletter we put out with updates and pointers. The email address is teel@adax.com, teel@adax.com.
Say that again, please.
For an monthly, approximately monthly newsletter, teel, T-E-E-L, at ADAX, ADAX.com.
Okay, well, this is, as I say, just the beginning of, this is going to go on more. You're going to get more information about this. We need to stay informed. Thank you very much, Marcy Darnofsky. My name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.